Super grateful for Pastor Aldo and his band for helping us out this morning. What a wonderful time. So thankful for that. Let me just say a word about, as I already prayed for, but let me just say a few words about the recent events of last Sunday. I don't know if you come into the room feeling any anxiety or emotion or difficulty about that, because that tragic, indeed, it hurts our hearts. It is a very tragic situation, and it's a senseless rampage that hit our brothers and sisters just hours east of us, not too far from here. So we as a church family have been praying. I know I've personally been praying for them, and we've been thinking through preparedness for us. A tragedy like this could absolutely steal away our hope and make us begin to believe that all is lost. After tragedy rolls through the news feed, it could have a tendency to steal away our hope. But, church, it is precisely because of events like that that demand our relentless pursuit of Christ. We can't stop. We must pursue Christ with all that we are and hoping that that would drive within us a heartfelt love for our community. To hear and know the gospel that's about Jesus. The church cannot stop. The community, our neighbors, our own family, they need us to continue to carry the torch of the gospel that sheds light in dark places. Paranoia cannot be our response. Paranoia cannot be our response. But preparedness, wrapped in an unshakable trust of God, is our position. Preparedness, wrapped in an unshakable trust in our God, is our position. We want to be prepared to be wise and protective. But also our greatest preparedness is to receive with joy whatever may come our way. We are not guaranteed another day. So not only is our preparedness to be wise and to be protective, but we want to be prepared to receive with joy whatever comes our way, as tragic as it may be. Our leadership here will be making constant sweeps over the building. We've already been doing that. We continue to do that. We'll continue to have conversations on what it means to be prepared, what it means to be wise, but yet still gracious to all who come our way. Still gracious to anyone who chooses to walk in those doors. Now, we want to be prepared, but we want to be gracious. But we thought it wise, just for your information, be advised that there are multiple exits out of this room. There's not just one, there's multiple exits. There's two up front here, the ones that are closest to the wall there, those exit directly outside. Then there's two on the back walls there. If you exit out those, continue right, find the double doors, follow the exit signs, those will take you directly outside as well. Those are the quickest ways to get out of this building, which is a blessing to us. We have multiple ways out of here. But just be advised, be aware of that that's the way if something unfortunate were to occur. But know that our leadership is praying, and we're thinking through, and we want to be prepared. But paranoia will not be our response. We will be prepared, wrapped in an unshakable trust in God, and we'll be gracious all along the way. With that said, we're going to continue in the book of Mark as we've been looking at Jesus, our wonderful and gracious Savior. And I don't know about you, but there's times I've been floored with his actions. There's times that I've been comforted. There's times I've been challenged as I look at my Savior. Today, we're going to continue on in Mark chapter 2. We're going to bleed over into chapter 3. But let me read verses 2:23 to 3:6. It'll be up on the screen, or if you have a Bible, please do follow along, or if you have a phone, you can follow along on that as well. Verse 23 says, "One Sabbath he, Jesus, was going through the grain fields, and as they made their way, his disciples began to pluck heads of grain. And the Pharisees were saying to him, 'Look, Why are they doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath? And he said to them, have you never read what David did? When he was in need and was hungry, he and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God in the time of Abiathar, the high priest, and he ate the bread of presence, which is not lawful for any but the priest to eat, and also gave it to those who were with him. And he said to them, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. Verse 1 of chapter 3. So Jesus continues, and he entered the synagogue. And a man was there with a withered hand, and they watched Jesus to see whether he would heal him on the Sabbath, so that they might accuse him. Verse 3, and he said to the man with the withered hand, come here. And he said to them, that's everyone there, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save a life or to kill? But they were silent. And he looked around at them with anger, grieved at the hardness of heart. And he said to the man, stretch out your hand. He stretched it out, and his hand was restored. The Pharisees went out and immediately held counsel with the Herodians against him, how to destroy him. You know, one of the toys I remember most as a kid was a shape sorter. I don't know if you had this as a kid. It was an old school kind. It was blue on the top and it was red on the bottom. Or if you turned it around, it was red on top and blue on the bottom. But it had all these cutouts along the different halves of different shapes. As you put in the shapes, it had a handle on one side, a handle on the other, and then you would open it up and all the shapes that you sorted would just simply fall out. Now, I don't know why I remember that particular toy. Probably because it was quite springy and you could put people's fingers in it, and that was kind of fun. But nonetheless, now as my kids, I have kids of my own. Precious, wonderful kids God has given me. They used to also play with a similar toy that forced them to kind of sort different shapes. Now, at times, this caused great joy. They would celebrate. We got it right. It fit. And this is wonderful. But at other times, it was very frustrating. Why won't this go in? And if I just put more force, well, perhaps it'll slide in, right? And sometimes it was just to give up and toss it, right? As I've read this text and several other texts leading up to this moment over and over again, I envision in my head a theological sorter. A theological sorter, and maybe it has a red in the bottom top, I don't know, but somehow there's a way, a round ball of theological shapes cut into it. To where all one has to do is pick up the corresponding law or the corresponding action. And by keeping that law or by doing that action, well, that's the way they shoved that acceptable offering into the corresponding theological cutout. Now, this is how my brain works, and you may be thinking, what? But I see them saying we have distinctions and we have these cutouts and we have these actions that go along with this thought, and my life is to pick up the action, slide it in the cutout, and therefore I have pleased God. And one just repeat as much as possible to continue to fill the sorter with the appropriate action. And surely God is going to be happy. And surely I'm going to earn God's favor. But Jesus comes along and he puts a triangle and a circle cut out and it works. This does not go unnoticed. Jesus is doing things differently. And when they grab Jesus and they start to shove him into theological cutouts in their brain, he doesn't fit. And just like a child, they get frustrated. He doesn't fit with the ongoing actions that I've done over and over, and he's claiming to be God. It just doesn't work. It just doesn't fit. And this does not go unnoticed. Jesus has radically changed things. And for them, this causes incredible amounts of frustration. We see another tension, right? Verses 23 and 24, they give us the tension. What's the major issue? Well, they're working on the Sabbath. Jesus and his disciples are walking through a field. They're plucking heads of grain because they're hungry. Now, to you and I, that seems like a very innocent thing to do. Why is this a big deal? Why is it that they're so concerned as they watch Jesus' disciples, who what? Are a representation of Jesus. They're doing what he does, and they're working on the Sabbath. And the Pharisees, they come to him. They come to Jesus because of the disciples' actions. Look! Why are they doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath? Oh, they're so frustrated. What's the beef? What's the big deal here? Well, Sabbath is rooted in the creation account. That's where it first kind of comes out of. Now, the actual word Sabbath is not found in Genesis. It's not found in the creation account. But Genesis 2, verses 1 through 3, it states that on the seventh day, God rested. Or more accurately, it says he ceased creating. But it also mentions that he created the seventh day. So, Sabbath is rooted in something that God did. It's not merely just a simple celebration that God did looking back on day 1 through 6. Like, oh, great job. It's not just simply that, but it signifies that his creating was finished. He was done creating. He had made everything. It was wonderful. And now, on day 7, it was time for what he created to enjoy. The fruitfulness of what he made, the dominion that he had called them to, and the relationships that he had given them. It was a day for creation now to be what God created it to be. What's the first kind of beginnings that we see this ideal of rest? That's what Sabbath has in mind. Well, as we track the theme of Sabbath through the Old Testament, the first time we actually see the word Sabbath is in Exodus 16. Verses 21 and all the way through 30. Well, Moses institutes a day of solemn rest. He uses the term Sabbath. Well, why does he do this? Well, God had been providing food from the sky. That was fairly random, and that was a great provision to God's people. If you know the story, perhaps you, if you don't, you should go back and read it. God does a miraculous thing. He provides food from the sky. It falls, and then Moses says, hey, perhaps we should take one day. Because every day they went out, they gathered. But let's take one day and let's practice a Sabbath. God was providing for the Israelites. Food was falling from the sky. So the instructions go like this. They were to gather twice as much manna on the day before the solemn rest. Here's what's interesting is on that day, they gathered twice. The next day, the food was still good. But during the week, at various times, they gathered twice on, let's say, in the middle of the week. Well, the next day, guess what? It was rotten and didn't work. But on the Sabbath, it was still good. So the day before they were to enjoy this solemn rest, they gathered twice as much. And then they enjoyed God's provision on the Sabbath. And what did it do? It focused on his work, right? It focused on his provision. It had a way of ceasing the activity to not do nothing, but to enjoy what God had been providing them. The first moment we see the word Sabbath and it's instituted, practice this action as a means by which we remember God has provided. Then we go down in Exodus just a little further. We get to Exodus 20. Now, some of you may know exactly what Exodus 29 through 11 are. Well, those are the Ten Commandments. Kind of a big deal. So keeping the Sabbath, it now turns from a mere suggestion that Moses gave to a command from God himself. Because, as I mentioned, Exodus 20 is where Moses is given the Ten Commandments for the people to follow. This is a big deal. Exodus, in particular, it grounds the command in the creation account as well as a way of following God's lead. This is some of the reason why they were to practice a Sabbath. Well, God did. He rested. It really is kind of a mandate to imitate God. But there's no indication, once again, in the creation account, a cycle of work that ended with rest. But rather, as one scholar put it, this is great, its lesson is not that rest is good as a regular relief from work or a means of making work more efficient, but that there is more to life than work. That there is more to life than work. Rest is the goal and fulfillment of the work. Now, sure, we are energized and we do become more efficient, but it's certainly not necessarily about that. It is to take our focus on who we are in Christ and how God views us. Now, there's just a quick little snippet, okay? That's where we start to see the underpinnings of the Sabbath and why it becomes such a big deal for them. Now, the Sabbath kind of theology, well, it continues to move throughout all the Old Testament. And as it progresses through the Old Testament, it picks up more and more laws, more and more rules that they are to practice on this Sabbath. And it was meant to ensure that God's people would remember his provisions, not only his physical provision, but spiritual as well. As we go through and God delivers them from Egypt, well, part of the Sabbath was to remember God's provision and redemption. Keeping Sabbath became just as much about righteousness as rest, because rest meant Israel was obedient. There was something connected to as we rest, as we experience God's provision, perhaps there's obedience. But as the story of Israel continues, the laws about keeping Sabbath, they get intense. They get real intense, down to how many steps one could take on the Sabbath. You only had so many steps that you could actually take on the Sabbath. Now imagine that. That takes some planning, doesn't it? Perhaps you start to wonder, maybe I don't need that piece of food over there because I'm at, 92 steps and I've only got 100, well, I don't know, right? Like, how frustrating would that be? I mean, but this nitpicking, these laws that became the rule, guess what they did? They soon missed the intent of Sabbath, what Sabbath was to do for them. And now this is not anything unlike us. We want to reduce things down to 1, 2, 3 so that we can ensure that we do it right. But what had happened, and now when Jesus comes on the scene, these men are frustrated because you can only take so many steps. You can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do this. And here is Jesus' disciples, in their mind, not practicing Sabbath, breaking Sabbath, which the consequence was pretty staggering. But as we have seen, Jesus enters and he changes everything. His disciples, again, are noticed for following Jesus by not observing the strict Sabbath law. That's what they're noticed for. Their following Jesus was meant that they did not observe the strict Sabbath law. But that is the point of the law. And it had covered over the intent. The point of the law was to say, follow these and you'll be okay. But yet it had taken away from the intent. Really, what is at odds here is the law versus intent, which we'll get to. But then Jesus is confronted. Why are they not doing what we have done to please God? And they're going to be in tremendous amount of trouble. So Jesus gets confronted. But here's what he says to them. Have you never read what David did? When he was in need and was hungry, he and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God in the time of Abiathar the high priest, and he ate the bread of the presence, which, to remind you, is not lawful for any but the priest to eat. And he also gave it to those who were with him. 1 Samuel chapter 21, verses 1 through 6. You can check it out. But this situation has nothing to do really with keeping Sabbath. Perhaps it's the Sabbath day. It's kind of an odd reference a little bit. It's not directly mirroring what Jesus is going through. So why does he bring this up? I mean, the similarity really only is in that the law was broken. The rule was bent a little bit. Therefore, he's establishing and setting a precedent for what he is doing, what his disciples are doing, saying, hey, guess what? The great King David did the same thing. He took food from the holy place when the law said not to. Even the great king broke the rules, and no one said anything. There was something bigger that was governing his actions. And it would seem that the need was greater than the law. That it was okay to have something that superseded the law. Matter of fact, this is what's most fascinating. Using King David, who was God's anointed one, Jesus is almost placing himself saying, hey, I am just like King David. I can supersede this perceived law that you have. King David had rights, and I do as well. So really, what Jesus does is he's trying to highlight, you have law, but it's very different than the intent of what it was meant to do. So what do we have at play? We have the law that they kept versus the true intent. So Jesus redefines for them a great example of what we saw last week. This is a new wine. This is the teaching. This is what they have missed. So in verses 27 through 28, he said to them, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man, a reference to himself, is Lord even of the Sabbath. So the first thing we get is Sabbath was for man. It was actually designed for man to not lose focus of who and what God is. Since rest really is the enjoyment of all that God has created, that seems to be the original goal in Genesis 1 through 3. Sabbath intent was for man to be in a constant and joyous fellowship with God. Sabbath should not control the man. See, the law was in control of the man, and in doing that, well, they weren't free to actually practice Sabbath. Sabbath doesn't control man, as the law was doing, but should free the man to enjoy God, to focus on God. And there's really only one way to recapture that truth. The Son of Man is Lord even over the Sabbath. You see, Jesus referenced himself as the Son of Man. This is the second time in chapter 2 that he has used that term, and it's also found in Daniel 7. You can look at that, but what I want you to hear, this serves as a clear claim to Jesus' divinity, Jesus' authority. Just like King David, he has precedent over the law, and he wants to accomplish the intent of Sabbath. He's not merely satisfied with what the law has done. He wants man to actually find rest. I can imagine keeping all the laws that they had to keep to actually keep Sabbath. That sounds like a lot of work. And that sounds extremely man-centered. Look what I did today. Look how well I worked. Look how many boxes I checked off my spiritual growth chart. Look at what I did today. And Jesus is saying, you're missing it so much so that you're actually headed down a dark and difficult place. I want you to actually enjoy the intent of Sabbath. You see, the Sabbath law, not the intent, the Sabbath law does not supersede the Son of Man. It was intended to point to him. You see, the Son of Man is where rest is found. This is particularly played out in the very next story. Now, you may be wondering, why are we reading such this large chunk? They seem to be separate scenarios. No, they're not. Jesus is saying, this is what is at stake if you hold to law and not grab the intent of the law. See, I am the Son of Man. I am even Lord over the Sabbath. In essence, saying, I am where you actually find rest. So Jesus enters the synagogue, and a man with a withered hand was there. And they, the people that did not like what Jesus was doing, who could not fit Jesus into their theological sorter, they are watching him to see whether he would heal on the Sabbath so that they might accuse him. What a crazy way to watch. And he said to the man with the withered hand, come here. And he said to them, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or do harm, to save a life or to kill it? But they were silent. And he looked around at them with anger, grieved at their hardness of heart. And he said to them, he said to the man, stretch out your hand. He stretched it out, and his hand was restored. The Pharisees went out immediately, held counsel with the Herodians against him, how to destroy him. Implications of the Son of Man being Lord over Sabbath is that he heals a man on the Sabbath. You see, Jesus is in no way kidding about his claims. He's not just there to hear himself talk. There are implications to what Jesus is saying, and Jesus is saying, you're missing the intent, and if you miss the intent, you miss me. So he heals a man to show them that his teaching and his actions, they have immediate impact. They're not meant to just be stored away for a difficult time and then brought out to be used. You see, the Sabbath was for man. And more specifically and ultimately, it is for Jesus to deliver people from the shadow of death and restore into an unblemished image of God. Stretch out your hand. And his hand was restored. This is his work. And you cannot reduce that to a law to observe once a week. To do good is right any day. To do good is right any day. And here is what is at stake when the intent of Jesus' teaching is missed. A man in need is not helped. A man in need is not helped. He's in the synagogue, and Jesus sees a man, and he says, come here, and he looks around and says, well, what should I do here? Should we do harm, or should we do good? Should we kill? Should we not? And Jesus is grieved at their hardness of heart, which has been a long-used phrase to describe Israel's Old Testament wanderings away from God. God has been grieved before at their hardness of heart, and yet here the God-man is with them still grieved. Still grieved. Though they keep a strict Sabbath, their hearts were hard. Isn't that crazy? It didn't work. It didn't work. It didn't get to the intent of Sabbath to rest and focus on all that God had done. Their strictness, their legalism in trying to move the hand of God, it did not work. Everything about this section, verses 1 through 6, is slowed down to focus on the so-called religious leaders. And I think to in turn show us how not to follow Jesus. See, in Mark's gospel, it could be a tendency to read it really fast and move rather quickly. But Mark has a way of slowing down the action, much like that slow-mo scene in a movie, right? You know, the army scene and he's going off to war and it slows down and he looks over. I love you. You know, it like slows it down, and you're all like, yeah, we've been waiting. Like, what is that designed to do? It's designed to focus on that moment. Oh, it is happening, and it slows down, and bullets are whizzing by, and there he is. Every time that Mark mentions the actions of the religious leaders, of the Pharisees, he pauses. He has a way. Now, the English language is a bit anemic. We can't do this, but the language that he originally wrote in, he had a way of when they saw the word, they stopped for a moment and they saw it and they stood back. Every time he gets to the actions of the Pharisees, he slows it down and he draws attention. Oh, by the way, your strict Sabbath keeping has done you no good. Oh, right? To bring us in, to draw us in, to show us the inadequacies of keeping the law. To highlight, to slow down the moment and say the rules don't make your heart right. Check off as many boxes as you will, but they don't make you right. And here God had instituted a moment so that it would guard against this, to show that there's something better than work. What do the Pharisees do? What do the religious leaders do? They watch Jesus carefully. Not to admire him and to learn from him, but to catch him. They watch. Slow-mo. Oh, what are they doing? They're watching Jesus, not to admire him, but to catch him. How hard do their hearts have to be? Let me find the hole. Let me show you why this is ridiculous. Let me pull out of his actions to reveal to you that this is a fake, that he is not right. How hard does your heart have to be to not admire the man Jesus? All they're longing for is, let's catch him. Let's prove ourselves right. They remain silent when Jesus puts on display the absurdity of their Sabbath keeping. You catch that? Should I do harm on the Sabbath or should I do good? What do you think? Should I kill or should I preserve life? What do you think? Right, he's pulling out of them. How absurd. If you've hit your step limit, maybe they had, you know, Fitbits back then and they kept up with their steps, I don't know. But, no, I'm just kidding. Maybe you're close to your limit and there goes a man about to jump off a cliff. What do you do? Do you exceed your step limit? You go try to preserve life and help see the absurdity that he's drawing out of them? What do? They remain silent. Slow it down. Silent. Oh. To draw out that, are you serious? Do you think that this is the right intent of the Sabbath? And lastly, where he slows it down the last time is they conspire. It says they held counsel. With who? With the kingdom of the day. To do what? To kill the king of eternity. Staggering. We can't shut him up. Let's conspire with the kingdom of the day to try to eradicate the king of eternity. Oh, Mark knows what he's doing. And in a fast-paced gospel, he is slowing us down. To say, you know what's at stake? If you think that following Jesus is taking these actions and shoving it into a theological sorter and I've now pleased God, how much do you have to feel that thing? They watch, they remain silent, they conspire. They conspire on how to destroy him. The stage is now set. The cross looms in the distance as Jesus makes plain his divine work. Funny how those who wanted to hold to such a strict Sabbath keeping that included not killing are now making plans to destroy Jesus. I do a little bit of work on the Sabbath to carry out a plan to kill Jesus. I guess keeping the Sabbath at that point, there's something that superseded it. Now, I don't know about you, but I'd like to do our own pause here just a second and explore the question as to why do they want Jesus destroyed? I mean, at this point, we have covered so many situations where Jesus does something radical they question him, and they're taken back, and now we get the nail in the coffin, right? We're done. We look at Jesus. We sit here week in and week out, and we marvel at our Savior. We're taken back by Jesus' actions, and we're overwhelmed with his goodness, but they don't marvel. They actually hate him. It makes me wonder, how did they arrive there? And who am I to say that I wouldn't arrive there, if not by the grace of God? I don't know. But up to this point, as I've watched Jesus begin to remind them of the intent of the Old Testament law, which in essence was to point to God becoming man and therefore dealing with what we cannot deal with, our sins, that in turn would bring about our salvation. Perhaps they're upset because they're losing control. They're losing control to determine how my salvation will be won. They're losing their authority. Because the God-man has taken the theological shape sorter, he's opened it up, and all the stuff has fell out and says, guess what? It didn't work. It's empty. And begins to show them a better way. That why don't you pick me up and put that in your sorter? Because that's what you need. We marvel, and they hate him. Perhaps that they know that we're losing authority, and so if we can make him to be a fake, if we can catch him on keeping the Sabbath, perhaps we could gain our control again. You know, not too much unlike us, right? Being in control of your redemption. Do you know that being in control of your redemption is like controlling the weather? You can't. Being in control of your salvation is like controlling the weather. You simply cannot do it. The captive cannot pay the ransom. The busy bee cannot make itself stop. It just continues. So Jesus, in essence, therefore, he is saying that you don't have rest because you don't have me. Your unsettledness is really not tied to keeping the Sabbath, but your belief in me. Have you ever been so unsettled, like you couldn't sleep? Right, that's not a fun and grateful place to be. And he's looking at them saying, your frustration has nothing to do with keeping the Sabbath or keeping the rules, but your frustration is you don't trust me. And Jesus knows that he's punching the ticket when he heals that guy on the Sabbath. He knows it. He looks around and says, hey, what's best for me to do here? I'll take your lead. They're silent because they know. And Jesus says, for your own good, let me heal this man to show you what was intended by the Sabbath. Your unsettledness, brother and sister, this morning, even as you have come to Christ and you have surrendered your life, but perhaps your unsettledness this morning is really rooted in your trust in Jesus. Would you let Jesus define for you the intent of what it means to follow him? Would you let him set the rules? Would you let him lay the groundwork? Would you let him take the lead and then you would follow him? Jesus is our rest from the endless pursuit of making ourselves right with God. He's our rest. He is our Sabbath. Jesus gives us the right understanding of how to follow God. We should consult him. If we want to know how to live out our Christianity, perhaps we should ask Jesus, the God-man. We should let him to determine and let him guide us in our pursuit of God. And ultimately, we can't pursue God without him. Which, interestingly enough, he's God himself. who came and took his authority and sacrificed himself on a cross so that we could follow. Do you know that following Jesus means that rest in no way means inactivity? Let's just dispel that myth for a moment. Rest, Sabbath keeping, which, by the way, there's no indication in the text to say this day, absolutely. But I do think there is a sense that we should learn to rest. We should learn. But it doesn't mean inactivity. Working, doing good is essential to being a Christian. But work and doing good must always lead to rest in Jesus. Our work is an expression of the work God has done through Jesus. And this is why rest is essential, to slow our minds and just simply be men and women who've experienced the restoration found in Jesus, to just simply be, rather than gain more stuff, but rather sit in the comfort and the joy that God has loved us and God has pursued us in Jesus and he has restored us. You see, rest kills the nasty idol of materialism. Rest kills the nasty idol of materialism, which, by the way, cannot satisfy our soul. You, me, we cannot find rest in materialism because it's a never-ending game. More, 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 more. When you have all that you need in Jesus, what more do you need? What more do you think is going to satisfy your souls? One scholar, if this is helpful, put it this way. 6 days a week, we live under the tyranny of things and space. And on the Sabbath, we try to become attuned to holiness in time, and what he means in simply being what God has created us to be. It is a day on which we are called upon to share in what is eternal in time, to turn from the results of creation to the mystery of creation, from the world of creation to the creation of the world. To ground ourselves, to center ourselves on Jesus and enjoy what we have in him. Your unsettledness is not directly linked to your ability to keep all the rules, to check off all the boxes. Perhaps it's rooted in your trust in Jesus. And here's another side take, because I find it fascinating that this is the second occurrence that Jesus has been confronted because of his disciples' actions. Isn't that interesting? They've not come to Jesus and said, "Jesus, you said this, I can't stand you." They come to Jesus saying, "Your disciples are crazy. Your disciples are doing things that aren't right," and they're taking that as a reflection of him, because that's what disciples do, they follow their leader. But isn't that fascinating that the conflict has come by the disciples hearing Jesus, listening to Jesus, letting Jesus change their life, and people noticed? When you follow Jesus, it will be noticed. And sometimes, newsflash, not appreciated. It's unfortunate. But following Jesus, we need to know that if we really follow Jesus, it will be noticed. And sometimes not appreciated. But we're following Jesus with all that we are to put on display the goodness of God, to put on display where true rest is found. And you may not appreciate it now, but oh, I pray that in the end you will see it. When we follow Jesus, it will be noticed and sometimes not appreciated. But brothers and sisters, we would do well to slow our minds. Rest doesn't mean inactivity, but you might need to cease from doing something to reflect and focus on the goodness of God in your life. It was designed for us to see him and all that he is and simply be what he created us to be, and to rejoice in the work of Christ in our lives. This morning, I wonder if you are unsettled. If you are, I have one question to ask you. What do you perceive that your unsettledness is driven by? And whatever that answer is, I'll challenge it and say, is it really that? Is it really the job you need? Is it really the lack of funds? Is it really, I can't square up all that Jesus has said to me? Is it really that? I just challenge us to think through. Our unsettledness might be a great sign that it's driven out of a lack of trust of what Jesus has done. Now, am I saying that that's easy? No. But what I am saying, it's the best place for us to be. So if you want to talk further, as every week, there's my information. Feel free to contact me if you like. Let's pray.